Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew. I mean, seriously, not too much. We've been talking every single day this week on a podcast. What possibly else is there to discuss?
It's great. The bonus pod brought us even closer together. No, man, it's Thursday night, and we got a lot of mailbag questions here. And I'm in a good mood. Let's just run through it.
Let's do it. We got, as always, hundreds of quality questions. We spent, about half of today paring these down to the best of the best. One thing I've noticed, and tell me if you've noticed this too, we're getting some people kind of starting to pander just so that we're going to use their questions. Have you noticed that?
I have. So every now and then, someone will throw in a reference to the Wizards, hoping that that increases the likelihood that we read it. And honestly, that works. So continue doing that.
There's two strategies. There's the suck up variety of people who like know what we're really into and they're going to try to sneak in that way. And then there's like the crush variety where they're trying to egg me on to crushing you or vice versa. I actually encourage both of those strategies when it comes to mailbag because both are very effective. I mean, I definitely scan straight for the ones that say Sharp is an idiot. And I certainly get suckered into the ones that, you know, are proclaiming my greatness and, keep doing your thing, mailbag listeners.
It's great. Yeah, it's been awesome. Let's just jump right into it. Our first question is Kevin Durant related, even though we did go 30 minutes on the Durant injury a couple days ago. George from Mexico asks, was Zaza flopping when he destroyed the Dubs season? Should he have yelled timber or look out below? And then a second question, did KD's injury prove Adam Gopnik's theory that we're living in a malfunctioning computer simulation? So quickly, Zaza was definitely not flopping. Gortat like pretty openly threw him to the ground there, right?
Well, I was going to say, I got a really angry piece of hate mail this week because in my like 6,000 word breakdown of KD's injury, I just casually referenced Zaza accidentally falling on Kevin Durant's leg. And the guy was like, there's nothing accidental about Marcin Gortat throwing him across the court. And then later in that game, I don't know if you saw this, but did you also see where Gortat kind of hit Curry on the way to the basket and Curry spent like an extra 5 or 6 seconds on the ground trying to kind of like compose himself before he got up? So there was a minute there where I was convinced that Gortat was a Cavaliers sleeper agent and like he had just been sent to destroy the Warriors' core superstar pieces to give LeBron his best chance yet at his fourth title. I mean, it was a pretty violent game, I guess, from that standpoint.
Well, and Gortat is not that violent a player. I think if you saw him, you would assume he's more physical than he actually is. But definitely the Zaza move was like low key kind of violent. And I remember the Curry thing where he was laying on the floor and there was definitely like 10 or 15 seconds where I was like, oh my God. So the Warriors are just done now for real. But he got up, which is always nice. And that's been true with Steph for a few years. Like every time he hits the floor, you kind of catch your breath a little bit. And I think that's just the way it's going to be with him.
Slow down here, though. Did you just insinuate that a guy whose nickname is the Polish Hammer, who comes from a family of boxers, is a little soft? Is that what I heard?
No, that's not at all what I'm insinuating. Gortat's not soft. He's just more of a finesse type big man. I mean, obviously, especially off the court, if you talk to him, he's like zero bullshit. Like, and honestly, coming into the year, he told reporters that like oftentimes he'll duck the media and duck his media responsibilities because he's afraid he's just too honest. And he's learned that it's better to just not say anything and have the team be pissed off at him rather than coming out in the media. So like as a person, he's not soft. As a player, he tends to be a little bit more of a finesse guy.
Yeah. So I didn't think it was anything truly malicious on the play with Zaza. It was just kind of unfortunate how it played out, but I do think the basketball gods held that against Gortat. And I say that for one very obvious reason. You saw him take that basketball to the face from John Wall, right?
Maybe that's what it was. That's such a
good
call.
It's karma. The basketball gods will always get you, Andrew. They'll always get you.
All right. Well, speaking of higher powers here, did KD's injury prove Adam Gopnik's theory about a malfunctioning computer simulation? That was legitimately the first thing I thought of. I'm pretty sure I alluded to it on the podcast we did a couple days ago. But yes, my first thought was the Adam Gopnik article after the Oscars. Did you see it at all?
I didn't, but please, like, give us the 30-second summary of this, because we are way off the deep end already in the first 2 minutes of the podcast. So please bring us back to earth.
This is why the mailbags are the best. I'd never paid attention to the simulation theories before, but after the Oscars, I read through that article and it got me, man, because they, like, this stuff just keeps happening and I can't handle it. The gist of it is that he thinks that we have always been living in a simulated universe, one of like several simulated universe. And this is not, this is not just him, like various philosophers. I think he mentioned a guy at NYU, but his theory is that now there is some merry prankster who's in charge of this and is screwing with the simulation. Either that, or it's malfunctioning somehow. And again, this isn't just Adam Gopnik. Like, other people think this, and I bought it after the Oscars. And really though, if Durant's knee had exploded or he'd broken his leg or something on 3-1, I would have completely bought in. An argument against this, because I sort of thought through this. One argument against this is that most of the like weirdest, craziest things that have happened to a specific corner of like Twitter that follows sports, movies, and politics. So I feel like if we were really living in a malfunctioning simulation, it would involve something more than just crazy sports outcomes. But again, if KD had really gone out on 3-1, all bets are off.
So the theory is that basically the higher up Truman Show like producers are deciding that they're sick of us complaining about how boring the regular season is and how top heavy the NBA is. So they've just got to kind of like roll the dice and like make it just a little zanier for us, like just throw us a twist, a curveball.
I think that's the theory, either that or that there's some sort of program that has gone awry. I don't know exactly. I haven't gotten into the particulars yet, and I don't want to let myself do that, because when I read more of that, I will convince myself that it's true and that it's happening. I don't need any like simulation theories. And I'm sure there are other real arguments to support this, but again, I'm not really that interested. I do. Yeah, I miss when all the
look, honestly, like, you just brought this up out of left field. I didn't know this was coming. You sound nuts. You sound
well, get
two
into
steps,
it, man.
You sound 2 steps shy of Andrew Bogut and about 3 steps shy of Kyrie Irving flat earth right now.
Okay. All I'm saying is that I don't totally believe this, but it's not as niche as you think. There are a lot of smart people who subscribe to this. I personally miss when all of the conspiracy theories revolved around the Illuminati. I don't like living in this simulation where just like nothing makes sense anymore, but it is what it is. I'm glad we could talk this through.
God, I'm sending this tape straight to your psychiatrist. But continue.
I have one more question about KD. Did you think we were too dramatic about that?
No. Do we catch crap for that?
Well, no, not really. Someone on Twitter called us soft, but I think we were reasonable. It's obvious he might be fine, but multiple leg injuries is a little bit scary. And I don't want Kevin Durant to become basketball's version of like Gale Sayers or something. The last time he went out with a leg injury, he didn't really get healthy the entire year.
I think there was a middle ground between panicking about that his career is going to be over, which you definitely did. And in your defense, you had serious lack of sleep, and I didn't really kind of reel you back like I sometimes try to. I mean, you were pushing off the deep end a couple of times, you know, really getting nervous that he was never going to be the same again. But there's a middle ground between that and just expecting he's going to come back in a month and they're going to just plug and play and everything's going to be fine. Like, I think if the Steph Curry thing last year taught us anything, it's that you think it's going to be smooth. You always look to the best case scenario on the rehabilitation timelines. And even if they come back on that schedule, that doesn't mean that they can just pick up where they were 2 weeks ago. And I think that they're in for trouble. You know, I think this is going to be much tougher. And building on that point, you know, I saw the Rockets in person last night. And granted, Mike D'Antoni did say afterwards that it was the best game they had played all year. They looked really, really good. And if Golden State's not clicking on all cylinders, that's a team that's going to be a real problem for them.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and again, we're in wait and see mode. You're right. KD's knee is like probably structurally okay, but who knows how long the recovery will be. Let's move on, though. Let's go to Celtics-Cavs from the other night. Harrison Peoples asks, is Avery Bradley the X factor for the Celtics? Everyone seems to forget. Averaging 17 points per game, 6 rebounds per game, but more importantly, stifling defense, which was on display last night against Kyrie. He can guard either point guards or threes in a pinch. And what do all the playoffs matchups have in common? Strong guard play. Over a 7-game series, I see him wearing these guys down. P.S. If Sharp says anything about Celtics fans overreacting, remind him about his beloved Wizards and their hollow victory over the Warriors. Fair enough. Also, second, we got 2 Avery Bradley notes this week. Jordan from New Zealand said, if Avery Bradley isn't a top 5 defender in this league, I don't know who is. He tied up Kyrie. So I just want to say, I love watching Avery Bradley play defense. It's like one of the, if you just follow him all over the court, it's like watching a shutdown corner.
Yeah, one of the things that I've never quite understood is that why there aren't more guards in this mold, like coming up the pipeline every single year and really sticking. I mean, clearly he's done a lot of work to his game in terms of developing the 3-point shot and giving a little bit of contributing offense that maybe wasn't there earlier on. But this is a mold that should be absolutely replicated. And maybe it's not going to get you paid like the scoring specialist Isaiah Thomas type mold, which is probably going to lead to a max deal. But he is one of the most useful types of players. You can play him alongside a ball dominant guy. He's not going to be crying about his touches. He can give you offense in a bunch of different ways. Maybe he's not initiating all of it. And then defensively, he covers up whatever your weakest spot is. And he does it in a way that really does wear people down. Or not to go back to the Rockets again, but I don't know if you saw Patrick Beverley last night against the Clippers and just how all over the place he was. I mean, these guys almost deserve more than X factor status. I mean, Harrison wanted to know if he's the X factor. Come the playoffs, they're more than just X factors. I mean, they're major, leading figures in whatever series and whatever matchup they're going to be in, even if they're not putting up 20, 25, 30 points a night.
Yeah, and Avery Bradley was hurt last year for the Hawks series, so that's a factor too. Like, I think he does kind of change things a little bit. I don't know if he changes things enough to swing a series, but you're right that these guys are all super important. And Bradley's kind of like the best version of this. Like, he's sort of Tony Allen with a jump shot that you don't have to hide on offense. And I think it is going to get him paid at some point. Like, at some point he's going to get $70-80 million, and then it kind of changes because you've committed like a lot of resources to him. But as good as Avery Bradley was, Jaylen Brown that night was just as impressive guarding LeBron the entire time.
Yeah, I mean, they have their fetishes, you know, their wing defender fetish. Yeah, there in Boston.
Yeah, Danny Ainge definitely has a type. Yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't take that much away from that game, but I do think like if Love's not healthy, the Cavs are going to have a dogfight with whoever they end up playing. Whether it's the Raptors, whether it's the Celtics, whether it's the Wizards, it's going to be close because they're vulnerable without him in there.
Yeah, I mean, we're praising Boston a lot here, but like let's also keep in mind that was their first quality win of the season, right? I mean, pretty much like that was their signature victory of the season, and it came in March. To me, that's a red flag. Maybe they're peaking at the right time. That's a real positive greed spin, but maybe they're just a very good team and not a great team. I mean, how are you feeling about Cleveland's vulnerability at full strength? I mean, they're about to get JR back. They've loaded up the bench parts. Love will be back with time to spare. I mean, are we just kind of forcing this? Like, is this kind of a talking point? Like, hey, like go Boston. They finally did it. Because there was like real excitement in that building that they beat LeBron. I mean, it's the first time I think he had lost there in Boston in like 4 years or something.
Yeah, I mean,
part of me wants to be like, okay, congratulations, Boston, you did it. The other part of me wants to be like, well, LeBron is going to lose every once in a while. Like, he can't be undefeated in every building.
someone on Twitter today posted screenshots from like various media outlets, all of whom were running like film packages or articles with the question, are the Celtics for real? And I think they were from different times over the last 2 years. So people have been trying to talk themselves into the Celtics for a long time. And I think you're right. You're right to be skeptical. But at the same time, like that stadium gets loud. It's fun. I think the biggest question for me coming out of that game would be Isaiah in the fourth quarters against good teams. Like he struggled against the Raptors too. It's not just the Cavs. And granted, like they were doubling him a lot last night, but against good teams in the fourth quarters, Isaiah still has something to prove.
Look, his comments too are going to come back to bite him. I mean, that's kind of the ones you wish where he could dial the confidence back just like half a percentage point, saying that nobody stops him. That's why he averages 30 points. I mean, that's fighting words. You know, that's bulletin board material. If you're the Cavs assistant coaches, that's on your locker room wall before game one of that series and everybody's trying to take him out. That might not have been the greatest idea from him. You know what I'm just realizing about the Celtics, though? This is kind of funny. They have a lot of guys who would make the All-Golliver team, like Avery Bradley's All-Golliver, you know, All-Star. Al Horford. I mean, Jay Crowder. But I still don't really like the Celtics that much. Like, I thought they were going to be really good coming into the season, but something's kind of missing. I don't know. Maybe it's just because they didn't do anything at the deadline, and you wonder if that's going to bite them, but I'm just having a hard time getting that ramped up for these guys.
Yeah, a friend of mine said that he loves all the Celtics players individually, but he thinks that Celtics fans have turned him against the Celtics and made them impossible to enjoy. So maybe that's part of it. I will say one more thing on Isaiah. I wrote about him this week. I put together a little interview. I did a little one-on-one with him in New Orleans, and then he was also interviewed by Sage Steele on stage at this small little like brand event. And my favorite thing that he said the entire afternoon, like he was pretty entertaining throughout, and we talked a little Seattle hoops. But my favorite thing that he said was basically like he was asked about the playoffs, and he said, "Look, honestly, I don't know how to win in the playoffs. I'm not going to lie to you. Like, I still have some learning to do there, but experience is the best teacher." And I like that he was honest about that, because there's like he's confident, but he's not arrogant. Like, he's not crazy.
That is really refreshing to hear, for sure. How else did you find him? I mean, how was that interview? What happened?
He's a good dude. I liked him. I talked to him before. And again, like it's sort of the honesty that that I appreciated most, is that like he's sort of down to earth, no bullshit, but is also he's not afraid to say things that are interesting. And he's like pretty confident. He was talking about his kids and how they prefer Steph Curry to him still. So he's entertaining, but we'll see. We'll see where it goes for him, because it is going to get interesting once it's time to pay him $200 million. But let's move on. Let's go to Philly real quick. Zach asks.
Oh, God. Here we go.
you hate talking about the Sixers more than any team in the NBA. Zach asks, is Brian Colangelo getting to the point where Sixers fans might miss Hinky? I think, I don't know which Philly fans Zach knows, but Philly fans have missed Hinky for like a year and a half. He is getting to
say, didn't he start at that point, and it's only gone downhill, right?
Yeah, it's Colangelo might be getting to a point where like Philly fans stage riots outside the Wells Fargo Center, but they've been pro Hinky all along. And then Mason asks, should Philly just waive Jahlil Okafor at this point? Colangelo toyed with him for months, and he's clearly miserable. I think he should just get a clean slate at this point.
Well, actually, now that you mentioned Jahlil Okafor, and you saw that Vine going around, or that video of him just like with the lowest possible energy on defense for that entire possession, and that's basically sums up his career in a nutshell. But now you've got me wondering whether that's part of the malfunctioning computer simulation that you were talking about earlier.
Because, Jahlil is malfunctioning.
like his backup battery just ran out of juice and he was slowly like dying on the court in front of us. That was pathetic. I mean, but at the same time, it's sort of like with Nerlens Noel and all the back and forth about the front office there and how we were always kind of taking his side because they wasted so many years of his life. As just completely unacceptable, unforgivable as that play was from Jahlil, and it's not like the rest of his play is that much better.
Yeah.
I actually don't really hold it against him or blame him that much. I mean, yes, part of me is just frustrated that he's not controlling what he can control, which is his effort level when he's on the court. But part of me is also just like, this is the most dysfunctional, stupid environment possible for the last couple of years. He made it very clear he didn't want to be there when he first got drafted and just dropped the jersey in disgust on the table as if, somebody had just like dented his fender of his car or something. I don't know. Like, I think that they probably should consider cutting him. I've joked about that previously. I thought for sure they were just going to trade him for one of those ridiculous top 59 protected second round picks and just be done with him at the deadline. They didn't do it. But I think it's in everybody's best interest to just get this over with as soon as possible.
Look, I'm with you. And I honestly saw that video and felt bad. Like, obviously it's pretty hilarious. It for me, it looked like me on defense at the end of a pickup game where I've like realized I'm out of shape. So I'm just kind of like lazily getting in position and trying to look busy, hoping no one notices. Like that was Jahlil Okafor in an NBA game. But I just felt bad. Like he's 20 years old and he's not James Harden level famous, right? Like I understand when James Harden has defense clips passed around Twitter, like he's still worth like $100 million and has an amazing life. Jahlil Okafor is just like miserable in Philly. And it just like Twitter made it into a Twitter moment. And it just seemed a little bit like over the top. And along with Jahlil Okafor's miserable life in Philly, like, yeah, they should cut him. I don't understand. I'm sure they've had better offers than just cutting him outright. So I'm not sure what the thought process is in Philly, but like, I think he could do well on a different team. He's not good enough to make up for all the other ways that the Sixers have sucked the last 2 years. He's not, and Joel Embiid is. So that makes Okafor look even worse. But I think that like in a different situation, with somewhere where he'd be motivated to actually work hard, like he could be solid.
I think he's going to have to get somebody who really gets through to him this summer. I mean, I think number one, they're going to have to figure out a way with his agent and his people to just get him a fresh start. I mean, no question about it. But then number two, he's going to have to take a completely new mental approach to the sport. I mean, he honestly looked like he was like on the losing team of a Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, basketball scene where like, yeah, Will Smith's pouring in like 40 points in a montage. Like that's what his defense looked like. Like he was just giving it up, you know?
I
think it's unsalvageable. And also going back to Zach's question about Brian Colangelo and Hinkie, like I can understand the excitement that Hinkie brought because he's thinking differently, but man, this guy did a terrible job in the draft, you know?
Yes.
I mean, to have Noel go out, to have Okafor just be this complete bust. And we haven't even mentioned Embiid. You're trying to bury the lead because we had that mock draft podcast. And I told you, if you drafted Embiid in the mock draft, that you're going to get yourself fired. And here we are, another season ending injury. You know, he's played less than Odin through three seasons. And now they have to decide whether they give him up to like $150 million on a rookie extension. I mean, this is a mess. And
yeah,
Hinkie, all of that has to be charged to Hinkie's reputation. I don't hold that stuff against Colangelo, although I can't really say he's done anything right since he got hired there.
It's true that Colangelo hasn't done much, and it is really true that Hinkie has kind of skated on a lot of this. Like, this is his mess that he created, and there are a lot of people who are sort of conspiracy theorists and think that Hinkie didn't really make the Okafor pick and that came from ownership. But like, I've talked to people who said that the Sixers really liked Okafor and that's who they wanted. So I believe whoever you want, but like he's got to own that disaster because it didn't make sense from day one. And I don't think you can pin the Embiid pick on him, at all. But everything else is Hinkie. Yeah, it's been a dark week for the process. Let's move on. From Tyler, I asked my wife, who tolerates a lot of NBA watching from me, how many games would the Spurs win with her as a coach? She said, not a lot, because I don't know anything about coaching. All I know is that I'm supposed to call a lot of timeouts in the last 2 minutes. Her observation leads me to this. Did teams get too many timeouts? Do you have a timeout opinion? I feel like you would.
Yeah, for sure. I think that there's been a lot of, I mean, this has been well-traveled ground, I think, but the back-to-back timeouts late in games where one team calls a timeout and the other team calls a timeout, those just need to go.
Okay.
There's too much stoppages of play late, no question about it. I love the coaches that trust their players in tie situations, especially to just play with the flow of the game. I think a lot of times it's easier to get good looks if you have intelligent decision makers in that free flowing idea than it is to try to do it out of a set, especially against good defenses. I mean, the scramble is always beneficial. From a television watching standpoint, I think his wife is correct. I mean, she's speaking for all of casual viewers, right?
Yeah.
Why does the last 5 minutes of a game take 45 minutes?
But I don't really have an opinion on timeouts. I think you're right that like just less of them is probably a good idea. But Tyler really buried the lead. Do you think his wife can coach the Spurs?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's times where Pop just opts out of timeouts. He'll call him and he'll just go stand on the court and he lets Manu run the timeout. And I don't blame him. Manu's a genius. And they've got Kawhi, they've got Tony Parker, they've got tons of institutional knowledge. I think Tyler's wife, if given Popovich's staff, could probably coax 50 wins out of the Spurs.
I'm with you.
Okay, maybe 48 to be conservative. But I think that she could put up a reasonable win total. I don't see why not.
I'm 100% with you. I don't think you could say that about any other team in the NBA, but I started thinking about it with my wife. Like the Spurs coach themselves pretty much. And there would be, you'd still have the assistants in place, one of whom is Becky Hammon. My wife would be very pumped that there's another woman on the staff. I like Kawhi. I'm not even sure Kawhi and Pop speak to each other. My wife would probably be a little creeped out by Kawhi, like, so that guy just doesn't have emotions. But that team sort of runs itself at this point. It would be like, and I almost would say that you could do this with the Warriors too, but like Draymond would probably cause some issues.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to put him in timeout every once in a while. That would definitely be a thing.
Yeah, all the hard work has been done.
All the hard work's been done with the Spurs in terms of establishing the culture and having the leadership, you know, pecking order already in place. I think that's the hardest part in the NBA. Now, conversely, how many wins do you think your wife could get out of the Pelicans?
I mean, I don't really trust Boogie. I feel like that could be kind of a toxic relationship.
She might be going like 8-74. You're going to have to count on a few 50-point games from Anthony Davis, a few lucky breaks against bad teams. But that could be one where there's like a strike or like a walkout midseason. The point here is that the Spurs are exceptional and that it'd be a lot easier to stand in for Pop.
All right. One more factor to consider with the Spurs. I don't know if you want to let your wife spend every day with Tony Parker, given some of the history.
Oh, geez. Don't be saying this. Tyler's going to listen to this. You're
yeah,
awful.
I'm just saying that factors into the hypothetical.
Have I given you my take about Spurs fans, though, that they've been so indoctrinated by the Popovich way for years and years that sometimes they're coaching the game like collectively, like the lower bowl fans are just like, you know, they know exactly who's supposed to be taking which shot when they have like this unbelievable, like just communal understanding of the right play and the right way to do things. And I would like everybody's knocked the Warriors fan base for kind of changing and selling out with the Bay Area and all the tech money. Like that has decidedly not happened with the Spurs fans. Like they're so rabid and so into it that you could almost just do away with the coaching staff and let the entire AT&T Center like vote like up or down, maybe by text message, like what play they should run. And I think the Spurs would still be able to get through.
So I really like the idea of Tyler's wife or my wife coaching the Spurs, but the idea of the fans coaching the Spurs just kind of made me hate the Spurs all over again. Let's move on. let's go to Samuel. He asks, is Buddy Hield developing into an all-star actually the worst case scenario for the Kings? Is there any scenario that could possibly be more dangerous than Vivek thinking he has the Midas touch?
Man, that one blew my mind when I saw that. And I think actually for Buddy Hield to do that, though, won't he first have to be a starter for the Kings?
Yeah, well, he's been all right, right?
Yeah, coming off the bench. He's coming off the bench for the Kings. Like they traded their whole team to get this guy, and they can't even carve out a starting role for him down the stretch of a lost season. I mean,
I like that move. I like that. They're easing him into his role as the next Steph Curry. That's responsible. Uncommonly responsible from the Kings.
The guy's 23. How much easing are we doing here?
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. So another Kings question. Jay Bamberhill asks, this is a comment. This is a comment that we got over the weekend.
This is little a criticism.
Lost, yeah. Little lost on your pronunciation of Divock. Since he's been in the league, I've never heard Divets. Is that correct? So did we mispronounce it?
I don't know which we were talking about, but I do know one person on this podcast struggles with the Eastern European name. So I'm not going to point any fingers, but that's why you should just call him Vlade, just like Goran.
Yeah. Well, if we did mispronounce it, I'll take the fall for it. It was probably my fault, but this is not a Goran Dragic situation. I mispronounced it again. Dragic. Look, I know it's Vlade Divac. So I don't know what happened on the mispronunciation, but it's Vlade Divac. That's an easy one. And Faoud asks, is it possible that we all jumped the gun too early proclaiming Cousins to New Orleans the worst deal of all time for Sacramento? And I will say this. I'm doing the mock draft. I'm in the process. I have to file it later tonight. It's Thursday night. There's a chance that they could come away with two top 10 picks in this draft, and they would be in really nice shape. And in that case, it would be less of a like crushing loss for Vlade. But there's also like the Pelicans continue to struggle, and there's also a good chance that not a good chance, but there's certainly a chance that the Pelicans land in the top three of the lottery, which means that the Kings get no pick, at least this year, for Boogie. And at that point, it really does start to look like one of the worst trades of all time. So it's going to be a tense lottery night for Sacramento.
I was talking to a writer from Sacramento the other night. I'm not going to expose who he was, but guess which of those two scenarios he was predicting was going to unfold.
Oh, if I were a Kings fan, I would be positive. I would be 100% positive that they are going to lose the pick on lottery night. And that's just the way life works. And I feel bad about that. But I think we should all be rooting for the Kings to not have that happen. But it's definitely in play. And by the way, that top three protection is why like the trade is unforgivable, because like, come on, like it was a bad trade before that, but to let them get away with protecting that pick is ridiculous.
Yeah, for sure. That would be so heartbreaking if that's how it goes down. I mean, that would be almost like there's going to be a lot of lottery intrigue this year between the Lakers, the Kings, you know, some of these other teams. Yeah, we could probably talk about that next week on maybe like a tanking special episode of like who really needs the odds to fall in their favor, because there are some truly desperate organizations to keep their picks who could wind up being just shattered if they don't have one.
Yeah, no, we should. The tanking race is heating up, actually.
It's full force right now. I mean, it's amazing how many teams are trying to fight to get down in the standings, and it's so packed that like night to night, they're definitely looking at the scoreboards, hoping for their other teams to win instead of lose. It's kind of backwards, but that's how it goes.
Alex Burr, this was a DM to you. For Friday, you should ask Sharp if he buys his old boss's theory that two crazy guys on the same team is bound for trouble. So this is Simmons's theory.
To be clear, Alex said this like 15 seconds after the report that the Warriors signed Matt Barnes.
I connected the dots. Don't worry.
Yeah. So the theory here is that somehow Matt Barnes and Draymond are going to find themselves in a combustible situation, either in the locker room or on the court, that's going to wind up tearing down the Warriors before Kevin Durant can come back to be the super team savior.
Yeah, I don't subscribe to that theory. I think in general, it really depends on the two guys. Like, I think, who's a good example? Like the Morris brothers, Markieff and Marcus Morris are actually better apart. I know they want to be on the same team, but I think that they are, it's a healthier dynamic to keep them apart. And I've talked to NBA guys who've said that. Draymond and Barnes, though, that can work. Like, first of all, Matt Barnes, if you go back, Matt Barnes and Steven Jackson were like a duo in Golden State 10 years ago. So it can clear, there's evidence that this can succeed. And I think that Draymond is like, he's crazy in certain ways, but he's also crazy in like a productive way. And that, so he's sort of less of a risk in that respect.
I think it helps that both their basketball IQs are pretty high. I mean, Matt Barnes off-court IQ might be pretty low. Long track record of really questionable decision making, some of it involving Derek Fisher. But on the court, he understands his role. He knows what he should be doing. Yes, there's occasional flare-ups here and there, but he's going to fit in fairly seamlessly. And he's also like the happiest person in the world. I mean, imagining you're Matt Barnes, you think your career is basically over. You played for Sacramento all year, horrible situation. You were tasked with like babysitting Cousins the entire way, trying to make sure you were the one guy who could get through to him. And then now you're just sitting around waiting for somebody to call, and your former team who you loved playing for, you know, local Northern California guy, now you get to hop on that bandwagon, this super loaded super team, and potentially make a run at the finals. And not only that, but you're going to play very important minutes for them because they have a huge hole while KD's out. He has every reason to be on his best version of his best behavior, right? And I don't see this being the thing that brings them down. I mean, if anything brings them down, it's that he can't do enough on the court to cover up for KD, or KD just takes too long to get back on the court. I'm not sure it's going to be like a locker room fist fight or like screaming that undoes the Warriors.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't want my wife coaching Matt Barnes and Draymond Green, but I'm weirdly bullish on how this can work with Steve Kerr. Like it's a good fit, and that's great. It's crazy to say that about Matt Barnes on like a contender. But he does, he fills a need, and he will fit in pretty well out there. So we should move on to Blazers here. Jonas asks, besides the Bulls, clearly number one, who is the most cynical franchise? As in, not really that serious about making the conference finals. They just want to hover around respectability, sell tickets, and D-Wade jerseys. Is it the Blazers? If they were serious about contending, they would have moved CJ or Dame, but the backcourt is fun enough to make them entertaining now. So you're our Blazers guy, man.
No, it's not the Blazers. The Blazers are not cynical. If anything, the Blazers were like way too
naive,
earnest in their excitement and naive, and like really thought that Myers Leonard was going to be the guy. You know, I mean, this is the team, like no cynical, you can't cynically pay Myers Leonard, $10 million a year for 4 years. Like you do that because you really want it to happen. Like you don't just like, oh, we're going to really like pull this one over on our fan base. Like you really had to think that it was going to work, and go right down the list with their deals. Allen Crabbe, Evan Turner, all of them, far more naive than cynical. I mean, the Bulls are almost on cynical island by themselves with this approach that, you know, really doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, another one that I would throw in there, maybe the Hawks. You know, you look at their, like the Teague move, letting Horford go, just kind of constantly aiming for the first round, you know, paying Joe Johnson, then trading Joe Johnson. I mean, they're always sort of like just trying to get by just good enough so that they're not like a laughing stock, but they're never really going anywhere.
That actually, I mean, our next question was about the Hawks. And it was Adam, why are we not including the Hawks in losers of the trade deadline? And the answer is that we're not including the Hawks because no one actually cares about the Hawks or wants to talk about the Hawks. So yeah, I'm with you. Like I don't think it's cynicism on their part though. I think that teams like the Hawks and Pacers like just don't really have many better options.
Yeah. You know, I'd say Dallas is kind of cynical too sometimes, in terms of like,
that's a good one.
Their goal for like the last 5 years has been to like pray to win a first round series, right? And they're still doing it this year. Like, they're going gunning all out for that eighth seed so they can talk themselves into having like a 1% chance of winning a series, when they really should have just been tanky for the last 2 months. And yeah, so I would say that those are the most cynical teams. With the Hawks, though, it's really weird, though. I mean, when the highlight of your last 40 years as a franchise was getting swept and embarrassed in the Eastern Conference Finals, like, you think that that would create a moment of clarity and reflection of, like, just changing how you want to do things. But, you know, financially, they just don't seem all in, you know? And I think that's what separates the teams that are truly contenders from the ones that aren't.
Yeah, I think it is the big picture, like, takeaway from this question is that owners are just really, really important to how successful these teams are. And I think sometimes it's not necessarily that owners are not committed. They just may not be as rich as some of the other owners. And that might be the case with the Hawks. I haven't actually looked into it. I think I just called the Hawks owner broke, which is not intended, but yeah, it's tricky. And the Mavs thing is interesting because as they grind out these winning seasons in years where they'd probably be better served by sort of bottoming out and resetting a little bit, I always pin that on Rick Carlisle, but there's gotta be more to, like, it's gotta be Cuban too. And sort of the rest of the organization, which sort of refuses to face reality.
Yeah. I was going to say, maybe they're not cynical. Maybe we should take Dallas back out and maybe it's just denial. You know, like, seems like there's some pretty thick denial there.
Yeah. Big picture, Bulls are definitely number one. And I also think that the obvious answer is the New York Knicks.
Yeah. I mean, cynical is almost too nice for the Knicks, though. I mean, they're so less accomplished than the Bulls in recent years that they don't even get the benefit of, like, talking themselves into keeping their head above water. I mean, they're just constantly drowning and, Yeah,
fair enough. So Adam asks, who would you rather spend the next 5 years with at the three, LeBron or Kawhi Leonard?
Ooh, five? I think I'd still take LeBron.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's pretty close, but I think he's got to at least, I mean, this season has been a really impressive year from LeBron in terms of how much he's been able to hold up, crazy numbers, not really slippage. In some of the indicators that you'd look at, his willingness to play the minutes, not whining about feeling broken down. It seems to me like his prime might last longer than people expect, like most people would look at. And if that means 2 to 3 more elite years, I'll take that.
This is a wild, wild role reversal for us, because I think you have to take Kawhi here. Like, LeBron, I understand, is basically a guaranteed trip to the finals, but I can't imagine that this lasts more than another year or two. Like, it just physically shouldn't be possible to play this many games and not break down. And I feel like we're kind of due for a letdown soon. I mean, like, not in June. Like, I think he can make it through the season. I think he can probably make it through next season. But if we're talking 5 years, like, Kawhi is going to be a top five-ish player that entire time.
Yeah. I mean, 5 years does take LeBron to age 37. I mean, that's where it starts to get pretty dicey. But I just ride the first 3 years of it and, you know, chalk up the last two, you know, good to go. I mean, also part of it's just the landscape in the East is, like, it's very possible LeBron makes the next three finals.
Yeah.
And so that puts him in position to win more titles. I mean, I'm all about winning titles here. In the West, I mean, it's always going to be a higher degree of difficulty there. If Kawhi was on the Cavs and LeBron was on the Spurs, my answer would reverse.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense. I'm thinking of it in a vacuum. Like, regardless of rosters, like, who would you rather have or add to your team right now? Like, if I could choose between adding LeBron to the Wizards or Kawhi Leonard to the Wizards, I think I would choose Kawhi, although I didn't think about it. Like, 37 is not that old. Like, LeBron will still be, like, a factor in the league at that point.
Yeah. I mean, I think that you're putting too much emphasis on the entire length of the 5 years, whereas what are the known quantities, like, right now in the first couple of years? I mean, this is really how a lot of people get into trouble handing out contracts, because they just say, look, we'll just give them an extra year or two at the end because we need the help now. But LeBron's averaging 26 points, basically a career high in rebounds at 8. And he's averaging a career high assists at 8.9. Those are stupid numbers.
It's crazy.
He can definitely do that again next year. And he can definitely do 90% of that the year after that. And I guess I would take him in a vacuum regardless. And part of me just wants to take LeBron so that you can continue to tell me how great Kawhi is.
Yeah. Part of me, the reason I'm choosing Kawhi is because every time I've watched a Spurs game this year, which is granted only like 4 or 5 times, but every time I'm blown away by how good Kawhi Leonard is this year. It's just a whole new level. And this is a really good question. Like it's a much closer call than people might think. So that's all I can say.
Yeah. To me, the biggest gap right now is just the playmaking style. I mean, LeBron is still doing so much more of that than Kawhi. But how that game winner Kawhi had the other night over Paul George.
Yeah.
Ruthless.
It's this stuff is getting routine for him. And I mean, no one really cares about the Spurs in the regular season, which is completely fair, but Kawhi is doing crazy things night to night. And as you point out, so is LeBron.
Do you know when people are going to care about the Spurs, though?
Probably never.
No, the third week of June when they take down the Cavs in 6 games.
All right, cool. Yeah, I like various Spurs people. So Zach Powers asks, did Brandon Jennings signing with the Wiz and my guy, fellow Alaskan, Mario Chalmers' hopes of playing this weekend? Assuming Rio just isn't back physically, if he's healthy, he's better than many playoff teams' backup point guards. There's no way Sharp would rather have Jennings than Chalmers playing spot minutes in the fourth quarter of a playoff game. First of all, I'm really pumped that we've got listeners in Alaska. That's awesome. I will say that I would have liked Chalmers, but I'm so, so excited to root for Brandon Jennings on the Wizards. I've loved Brandon Jennings since he was playing basketball in Rome. This is destiny. It's all coming together. And I do think that he will make a significant difference maybe not. He won't make that much of a difference, but like I would rather have Brandon Jennings than Deron Williams.
You know, he's shooting 38% this year, right?
Yeah. All right. If you put him on the floor for 10 to 15 minutes a game, like he can be perfectly fine. He's such a massive upgrade over Trey Burke. Like it's progress.
The two of them together is about as bad as it can get in terms of like guys who I would want to watch play if it was my team.
Guys who just drive you insane.
Yeah. I mean, this is like a recipe. Like if you're trying to create heart palpitations, Trey Burke and Brandon Jennings is a great place to start. I mean, I guess why not if you're Washington, like it does kind of help. I mean, you know, it's another body, but
do you have any opinion on Chalmers though?
I mean, how quiet has he been? And then how did he really not get any run when LeBron was like whining for help?
That was
a damning evidence that he's done.
Yeah. I hope he's not. It would be fun to have him back, but maybe he's just, the knee is not coming along the way people expected. Can I give one quick general update on the Wizards?
Please.
Look, did you watch the Raptors game?
They smacked the Raptors, and you know who loved that.
Like they are looking good, man. They are looking good. Boyan is already coming up big off the bench. And most importantly, like I said at the trade deadline, he can play with Beal and Wall, whereas Lou Williams was not going to be able to play with Beal and Wall. So I'm pumped, and they are like still lurking under the radar. Like after that Raptors game, like I think all of America was watching the Celtics, but the Beal and Wall continue to look great. They've taken to calling themselves Death Row DC on Instagram, where Beal is Dr. Dre, Markeith is Snoop, and John Wall is Tupac. So. Like, I don't know if it's possible for me to love a team more than I love the current version of the Washington Wizards.
Yeah, I mean, just get it out of the way. I mean, just tell the listeners what you told me so that we can all laugh at you.
Nah,
I mean, you think John Wall is the MVP candidate. I mean, just go ahead and say it.
I was not prepared to talk about this on the podcast. I think my exact text message to you was, look, man, I can't bring this up, but someone needs to put John Wall in the MVP conversation. And I kind of stand by it. Look, And your response was, your response was, don't be a Celtics fan, which is perfectly fair. And that's really as far as the conversation needs to go on John Wall's MVP candidacy. But he is, I will say this, he's better than people realize even now. Even as people sort of talk about him as like a third team all-NBA guy, like he's better than that.
It's an amazing three-way race between DeRozan, Isaiah Thomas, and John Wall right now for sort of like trying to take the next step towards just general acceptance of their superstardom. Of the three, I would definitely rather have Wall over the other two. But this is basically going to be decided by whose team makes Eastern Conference Finals. And it's one of the most fascinating storylines that we've got going right now, because it's kind of like a rock, paper, scissors. Like if you ask Raptors fans who they would want of those three, I think a lot of them would pick DeRozan. If you ask Celtics fans, they would all say Isaiah. And if you ask Wizards fans like yourself, you wouldn't trade John for either one of those guys, right? Not in a million years.
Not for those guys. No.
That's what I'm so, but like I'm saying, in a heads up scenario between those three of those three fan bases, don't you think all three fan bases would stand out for their guy?
Yeah, sure. And I don't want to be seen as like a hopeless stan. I think I probably am regardless, but I'm not a crazy Celtics fan when I say that Wall has been on that level. And look, Isaiah has been on that level too.
Come on. Neither one of these guys is that good.
Yeah.
They're not like top five MVP good. Come on.
All right. I would say that they are both having that kind of season. I think, all right. See, we should have ended the conversation earlier. all right. Finishing up here, a couple more.
No. Don't change the subject. I mean, like, let it out here. Let it hang. Like, let your Markieff Morris's hang here.
No, man. No. I had a question. I actually wrote in my own question here. Is the rookie of the year a curse? I'm looking at the field right now. First of all, I'm guessing that you don't think that Joel Embiid has played enough games to win Rookie of the Year.
I put out a chart that showed just how stark it is in terms of his minutes played. Like he's not even up to where guys have been at during lockout shortened seasons. He's roughly half as many as Patrick Ewing, who was the lowest during a full 82-game season. But it's tough. I mean, who is the counter-argument? Like, who else really should it be? I don't see a great candidate jumping off the page. I don't know. I'm willing to be sold on anybody, whether it's Brogdon, Saric, whatever, but like there hasn't been a strong enough performance by anyone else to really feel passionately that Embiid should win it.
That's interesting. I kind of figured you would be one of those accountability guys. Like if you don't
I
want to
be, trust me, the first ability is availability. And that has been a huge problem for him the whole way. You know, that's one of my favorite slogans. His season has completely followed the Greg Oden playbook of getting everybody's hopes up, showing more than just flashes, being a complete game-changing presence, and then just disappearing off the face of the planet amid very strange front office maneuverings. And I'm not really banking on him at all going forward. I mean, anything he does is going to be gravy to me because he's already multiple injuries deep here. You know, I mean, this is a demonstrated track record, and he's not that young. I mean, he lost 2 years already, and the Embiid optimists, you know, for good reason, once they saw what he could do on the court, tend to kind of gloss over that.
Totally. Right? I'm with you. I think we all sort of have to hold our breath and chill on the Embiid hype for a little while here, because I think even the Embiid optimists are sort of pausing things for a little bit and just to see, because nobody even knows exactly what his injury is. Like the Sixers have been super vague and like at times deliberately misleading, so it's hard to really gauge what's going on. It definitely, there are the parallels to Oden are pretty wild. I would say I'm glad that you're open to Embiid as Rookie of the Year. I think he should be Rookie of the Year solely because that 31 game stretch was so remarkable that it became one of the biggest stories in basketball this year. And like end of the year awards are supposed to memorialize like the biggest stories of the year. And then what people will remember about that season, and like whether Embiid plays again or not, he's going to be that story.
Yeah, and what's tricky too is there's not a great candidate on a team that's like going to the playoffs.
Yeah.
Where you could really get excited about like, oh, well, they played really meaningful minutes. I mean, like, even with Brogdon, like his case to me would be a lot stronger if they're like the 5 or 6 seed and if they were still on track to kind of win a series, which, you know, I thought they were, you know, not that long ago, maybe 6 weeks ago.
Yeah.
But we don't really have anybody in that place. I mean, even the guys who are playing minutes early, like Pascal Siakam and in Toronto, Sabonis maybe could be one guy, but you know, like he's averaging like 6 and 4. Like that's really tough to say that's better than Embiid, even if he's out there every night.
Yeah. Well, so thinking about the rest of that field is what the original question was, is Rookie of the Year a curse? And maybe that's the wrong way to put it, but it just feels like this award is kind of turning into a version of like the Heisman Trophy, where like winning it doesn't actually signify anything anymore. Because if you go back to over the last like handful of years, Karl Anthony Towns won it last year. And obviously he is the real deal and the best rookie from that class. But then you had Wiggins win it and people sort of used that award to talk themselves into him as like a franchise player. And that just wasn't the deal. And the year before you had MCW win it. And we all know how that turned out. Lillard won it and he's good. He's like a borderline all-star, I think. Kyrie won it. And until LeBron came, would have been in the same category as Lillard. Blake Griffin, he is legit. Like he's a franchise guy. Tyreek Evans, who won it over Steph Curry and James Harden. You can find more superstars. I guess my point is this. You can find more superstars in the NBA who kind of flew under the radar their rookie year, did not win Rookie of the Year. Like Stephen Harden lost, Kawhi, Russell Westbrook, Giannis. You can sort of go through the league and most guys struggle early on. And so I was watching the Celtics game looking at Jaylen Brown, and like Jaylen Brown to me is the most impressive rookie I've seen this year. Granted, Simmons has been hurt, but like number one, Danny Ainge deserves a ton of credit for that pick because Jaylen Brown was like not a consensus guy at number three and Ainge pulled the trigger and it looks smart. And he like Jaylen Brown's has no shot at Rookie of the Year, but if we're picking who's going to be best in 5 years, like he's probably right in the mix.
Yeah. So I think what you're kind of hitting on when you're going back and looking at some of the guys who won it versus the best player who's come out of that draft, it just all boils down to how long did they stay in college? How much of a finished product were they when they came to the NBA? And then how much usage was thrown at them in year one? Because so many of the guys who win the Rookie of the Year is just because they play for terrible teams and they get the ball every single possession. They put up empty stats. Here's my proposal to you. Tell me if you would prefer this. Instead of the Rookie of the Year award, what if it was the under 21 or the under 22 award? So, you know, if you're a one and done guy and you come out and you're not even 21 until your third year, you're eligible compared to a guy who stayed for 3 years and, you know, he's a 21-year-old rookie. Would that be more reflective of sort of young talent? Would that be more meaningful and interesting to gauge than trying to talk yourself into Buddy Hield or Jamal Murray or whoever?
Exactly. Like Jamal Murray next year will be Rookie of the Year quality, probably. Either next year or the year after. Like I think we can all sort of count on some sort of Jamal Murray breakout, but like this year he's been all over the place because he's 19 years old. I love that idea. And granted, like all of this is meaningless, but imagine how much fun the debates would be if it were like Karl Towns versus Giannis,
Porzingis,
and it was an under 22 award.
Yeah, versus Porzingis and Jokic and all these other guys. You know, maybe they broke out down the stretch of their rookie year, and you know now they're really having great seasons in year two, and they're still super young. Yeah, let's just call it the Rising Stars Award. Maybe you make it 22 and under. Maybe you put in a rule where you can only win it once. So if some crazy guy comes in at 19, he can't win 4 years in a row. I would personally way rather cast my imaginary vote for that than trying to pick through this ridiculous Rookie of the Year crop. And I also, it bothers me too, because year after year, we say, oh, what a bust this rookie of the year crop was. Oh, there's not any good candidates, right? But it's just because they're teenagers and it's too hard to be a teenager in the NBA. I mean, that's all it really boils down to. There's going to be a lot of good players from this draft.
No, absolutely.
Ben Simmons, Brandon Ingram, Jaylen Brown. I think Chris Dunn's going to have a long career. I don't know about Buddy, to be honest, but Jamal Murray, if you listen to Thon Maker, he's going to be an MVP. I mean, there's guys in this draft class who are going to be big time players, actually not that too deep into the future. And yet the conversation about them right now that everybody's having is, oh, they're so crappy. What a mess. There's nobody who's even close to being as good as Embiid. And yeah, no kidding. I mean, Embiid's been three years out of college. He should be a lot better than them.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's another sort of strike against his rookie of the year candidacy. Thank you for coming up with that idea and taking my like sort of vague frustration and turning it into something productive. I think we should start pushing for that.
Well, I was actually going to really pat you on the back because for a question that you answered or you asked yourself, you had a great answer for it. So it's like that's a pretty good tweak to this whole mailbag concept.
Well, it was mostly just watching the Celtics game and being like, you know, Jaylen Brown is good and I can't get too excited about Malcolm Brogdon, although Malcolm Brogdon's been good. So I don't know. Let's finish up with two questions here from JMo's Thoughts. First question. What would you prefer Adam Silver to do with his commissioner power? Take the Knicks off of Dolan or replace Shaq with literally anyone on inside the NBA? First of all, the answer there is definitely the Knicks. I'm kind of waiting for Adam Silver to make that move.
Yeah, he just has to find another sucker who's willing to overpay like Ballmer did by like 4,000%.
It's just, you got to think that it's only a matter of time before Silver sort of gets fed up with this.
I mean, that kind of gets lost in the whole Clippers Donald Sterling thing is, I mean, the price that Ballmer wound up paying for the Clippers was absolutely nuts. Like, I think that that could have been a much longer and uglier, protracted end to the Sterling era had Ballmer not just come out of nowhere with $2 billion, right? Like if he had really wanted to make that a negotiation and not just some crazy godfather offer, how long would that have dragged on? I mean, seriously, like it could still be in the court system right now. So if you're going to come up with a price for Dolan, I mean, like what's Dolan's cash out price? $5 billion for the Knicks?
Well, that's the thing.
It's his whole life. He's younger. I mean, that's like his whole social status, his entire livelihood is geared around the fact that everybody has to kiss his butt because he owns the Knicks, right? And if he's just JD in the Straight Shot, you know, musical superstar, like he's not going to have nearly as many friends.
Yeah, that's a good point. And that really was sort of a lightning in a bottle situation with Donald Sterling. Like it's amazing that sort of coup was so well executed. It was tenuous legal ground that the NBA was standing on there, but they pulled it off. So, you know, hope for a miracle. If you had to choose between Silver taking the Knicks from Dolan or, by the way, I don't like Shaq, but I don't dislike him enough to make this like a dramatic answer. Like Shaq's fine. I just don't really pay attention to him. Whereas it would be awesome if the Knicks had like competent ownership for the first time in 20 years. But if you had to choose between Dolan losing the Knicks or Vivek losing the Kings and moving the Kings to Seattle, which do you choose?
I mean, definitely fix the Knicks because we have to talk about them constantly. And there's going to be a situation here over the next few years with the Kings where because they don't have any superstars, like there's not going to be this Buddy Hield hostage situation like DeMarcus Cousins where we have to follow this step by step for the next few years. I mean, they're just going to disappear off the face of the planet. And eventually, hopefully, they'll come back and you know be a playoff team that we can get excited about. But they're going to be bad for a while and completely overlooked. I mean, they're probably headed for Suns territory here where most people just ignore them. And they're unfortunately, just because of the way the media markets work, we can never avoid the Knicks. I mean, Phil Jackson's still going to be there. Melo's still under contract. Porzingis is still developing into this potential you know league-altering presence. And none of those things are ever going to kind of wind up with a good solution or a good resolution as long as Dolan's there. So absolutely save the Knicks from Dolan. What do you really think his price is? I mean, honestly, like what would you put at like, okay, fine, I'll get out of here. Like, what is his, I'm going home and I won't come back price?
I think you make a good point about his identity, because he really may not have a price. Like,
he's one of those people, like the ultimate high
ulcers. Well, it's just so intertwined. And granted, like, if I were him or if I were in his life, I would be like, listen, this has not helped your reputation or your identity or the way people think of you. But I think he clearly doesn't see that. And like, in the aggregate, though, I think a team like, if the Clippers went for $2 billion, a team like the Knicks or a team like the Lakers could go for $3
billion. I was going to say $5 billion. I mean, really. Like, and part of it is, I like going to Clippers games, but still, like the game last night, they're playing the Rockets, national TV. This is a big time potential playoff preview type game, right?
Yeah.
Blake's healthy. Chris is healthy. DeAndre's playing like an all NBA first team player this year at center. And you're getting an MVP candidate, maybe the MVP favorite in Harden. You go to the game, nobody's there half an hour before the game. It's quiet. They're doing these charity auctions for the Clippers gear. You know, you could buy DeAndre's autographed shoe. There's like one bid for it. You just go right down the list. Like, the excitement, like the just the prestige factor of the Clippers just isn't there. And it probably never will be. And you look at the Knicks, like, that is the one thing that they have. Like, generations of diehard fans who are completely reinstilling the prestige factor into everything that they do, waiting for Jeremy Lin to come along so that they can declare him a global phenomenon for 2 weeks of good basketball, right? That's like, their just entire livelihoods are geared around trying to turn the Knicks into this respectable, amazing product again because of 1970 and 1973. He is sitting on an absolute goldmine and he's squandering it. And I think that it's got to be degrees of greatness more than what the Clippers went for, even though that price was already degrees of greatness more than what they were actually worth.
Well, that's my thing, is that the Clippers price had priced in like a hypothetical TV deal that never really happened. And the Knicks, you're right, they do still have that prestige somehow. It's amazing that they still do, but it still feels like an event to go to walk into Madison Square Garden. Like, even when I go, it's awesome. But I just don't know if they could get that much more than the Clippers, because I think people are expecting the TV bubble to burst, and that would be priced in as well. I'm glad that people can listen to two non-business experts discuss the hypothetical price of the Knicks.
Well, look, I'm not basing this on what reality is. I'm trying to look at this solely through the lens of like Dolan. And if Dolan's sitting in these board of governors meetings and he's thinking like, this Clippers guy over here who doesn't matter, paid $2 billion for his, I really matter because I'm the center of the universe because I'm Dolan and my team plays in the middle of Manhattan and I could get these buildings sold out every single night, no matter how ridiculous it is, no matter how many of my former team's legends I can drag out of here with security, I can still sell this place out, 41 nights a year. He's got to be thinking that that's where the value of his franchise would be.
Yeah. Well, and again, he doesn't want to sell, so you're going to have to overpay big time. Last question, but we could dream. We can dream. Last question from J-Mo also. Seeing as Magic was looking for a GM with a strong analytics base and tight relationships with those in the NBA, why were you not considered for the Lakers GM spot? Due to your nerdy-ish love of stats, this is in parentheses, and tight relationship with the Brow, as demonstrated by your recent All-Star story. This was a DM specifically to you, so... He's asking, why was Ben Golliver not considered? And
that's the best question we've gotten, wouldn't you say?
I mean, totally.
Like, honestly.
If you wanted a question that was guaranteed to be read on air, why don't you think you were considered, Ben?
Oh, it's just strange, inexplicable. I don't understand how I didn't even get an interview. It just kind of happened behind my back, just like Jim Buss. You know, Jim Buss gets popped from his job and he doesn't even realize it's really coming. I don't even get an interview. They just hire Pelinka. It's shocking that that's how it went.
Yeah, I'm not sure that you'd have the bedside manner to deal with NBA players on a regular basis, let alone, I mean, your like blatant disrespect for various GMs across the league could also prove problematic. But look, I'm not gonna rule out anything for you down the line. I'm not gonna tell you how to live your life.
Well, I'll just settle for my award-winning Instagram account. I'm making huge waves on a new social media platform. I'll settle for 5-star reviews on iTunes. And I'm sure the GM offers will start rolling in here if I just stick to what I can do best.
Just keep Instagramming, man. And I don't even want Basque. I just want your nature Instagrams. I'm a big fan. Everybody, thank you for sending in questions. And thank you for listening. 3 pods this week. We will be back next week on Tuesday. And everybody have a great weekend.
Yeah, and in all seriousness, send me your DMs of which teams Sharp could be the GM for. I want to hear the best arguments for which team he could really lead into the next century, or alternatively, which teams you want him to run into the ground and why. Let's hear this. I mean, let's open this up.
I want to be completely honest. The reason I included the Kings move to Seattle hypothetical is because my life plan is for Seattle to get a basketball team, and then I'm going to move out there and get a job. Like, I don't care what the job is. I'll take a job in the Seattle Sonics, because they have to be named the Sonics, right?
Oh, yeah. They've made sure that they're going to have the history and all that, too.
Yeah, okay. So I'm going to get a job in the Sonics mailroom and just work my way up, and I'll be happy out there, and there'll be a lot of Seattle bucket getters around me. You can move back to the Pacific Northwest. We can start doing the pod in person. It's going to be great.
I can't wait for you to be the Sonics GM so I can just rip you on this podcast.
Yeah. All right, man. Well, I will talk to you next week. We've talked too much this week. I'll talk to you soon.
All right, bro.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.